Hi there, welcome to New Books in East Asian Studies, part of the New Books Network. I'm your host, Lori Dickmeyer. I just finished speaking to Dr. Ji-Yun Lee, the author of China's Hegemony, 400 Years of East Asian Domination. That came out in 2017 with Columbia University Press. This book is very insightful and clearly written, and it's looking at China's hegemony and power from a social science perspective. She is looking specifically at the Ming and the Hai Qing periods from the perspective of less powerful East Asian actors, that is, Korea and Japan. So this book is going to be interesting for those interested in East Asia in general, both historically and the present day, but it's also going to be interesting for those who would like to look at international relations and the working of power. So the power she's looking at here isn't just, you know, the military or economics, but it's about legitimation at the domestic level that matters in international relations. So again, this is an extremely insightful book, very interesting, and I can strongly recommend it. So I hope you enjoy our conversation. I did. Hello, everybody, and welcome to New Books in East Asian Studies. I'm your host, Lori Dickmeyer. Today, we'll be talking to Dr. Ji-Yun Lee about her new book, China's Hegemony. Ji-Yun Lee, welcome to the show.
Thank you. I am glad to be here.
Thank you. I wonder if you could begin the interview by telling us a little about yourself.
Sure. I am a scholar of international politics, teaching in the School of International Service at American University in Washington, D.C. That's where I teach courses on Asian security, foreign policies of China, Japan, the two Koreas, and the United States.
And how did you come to write China's Hegemony, 400 Years of East Asian Domination?
I was actually born and grew up in Korea. And when I came to the United States and started studying international relations at Georgetown, where I did my PhD, there are a lot of things that didn't make sense about international relations theory for me. Later I learned that that's because most international relations theorizing draws on European historical experiences, and there was very little space for Asian history in the field. But I thought, you know, the experience of Chinese Empire and Asian diplomacy prior to the 19th century are just really full of very fascinating histories and important details that can enrich our understanding about how international politics works. So that actually became the primary drive for me to go much deeper into Asian history as a political scientist.
Thank you. So it seems to me that your main focus in your book is looking at China's relationship with supposedly subordinate powers like Korea, like Japan during the Ming and Qing dynasties, and the role that they play in the tribute relationship. Could you tell us what your main argument is here?
Just to start off, I really became interested and actually took an issue with how in popular dialogue and also in IR scholarship, there's this idea that China, when it becomes powerful and rich, it's going to try to restore the tribute system to dominate Asia. But when you think about this, it's really the underlying assumption is this notion that a country with military and economic power can build a new international order. But I actually challenge this idea because international order is also about social relations. I actually try and look at how the Chinese Empire and the tribute system operated historically and find out that the tribute system was not really a product of China's power, and not even Chinese culture, but importantly shaped by its neighboring countries like Japan and Korea, and how they their leaders were using that Chinese authority for their own domestic legitimation strategies. So in this book, I look at and compare Korea and Japan and how they responded to China as the leading power at that time, and show they sometimes complied, other times defied, and or challenged China, not because of China's power, but because of their own domestic calculations and legitimation strategies.
In your first chapter, Understanding the Tribute System, you went into some more depth about how you understood the literature about the tribute system in history and poli-sci, other areas. And you decided that it wasn't the best idea to call the tribute system the tribute system. You decide instead to call it tribute practices. Could you talk a little bit about that?
Yes. Actually, starting this project, I was very curious to really find out what exactly the tribute system is. People talk a lot about this, and yet the fact of the matter is that this is a very elusive concept. For example, historian Mark Menkel, he talks about how the term is a later creation, and it wasn't something that contemporaries were using at that time. So I just really started surveying different contexts in different fields that were really using this concept or the phenomena, and found that there are at least six different trends of research that seek to understand this phenomena. And I think for one, I was able to confirm that the tribute system as a concept or phenomena is something that we, you know, in social science can match with the notion of hegemony. But in as I was actually really trying to understand the tribute system in the eyes of the contemporaries at that time, I found that there's more to this phenomena that is, you know, it was really a way of conducting their relations among East Asian polities and countries. What I actually did is I read the actual writings and reports by Chinese and Korean diplomats, the envoys who visited each other's capital on a tributary mission, because I really was curious to find out how this, you know, notion of authority was expressed and manifested in diplomatic settings. And that's how I came to offer a slightly different explanation or approach to the tribute system by proposing it to look at it in terms of diplomatic practices, so tribute practices. So, you know, to me, it was really striking how prevailing a series of common practices were, and how shared their meanings that involved tribute, this practice of gift giving, and investiture, the practice of the grant of titles. So the meanings were such that in any given social relations in East Asian diplomatic settings, the meaning of A, sending tribute to B, signified that A acknowledged B's position to be superior to that of A. So in this case, B is going to be the Chinese emperor receiving tribute and granting the investiture. So this was a way of signifying and expressing their social relations. So I view the tribute practices as structuring how actors at that time conducted their relations, not just with China, but also with one another.
And in this first chapter, you also explained your choice of looking at Korea-China relations and Japanese-Chinese relations and not Vietnamese-Chinese relations. Could you explain why you made that particular choice?
It has to do with this book's design to use social science methodology. Vietnam would have made a good case, but I had two things in mind. One is that Japan and Korea actually make good comparison case because if you compare Korean and Japanese behavior throughout this, you know, hegemonic order period that I look at, basically from the beginning of the Ming Empire's founding through High Qing period, you see that Korea actually showed a consistently high level of compliance, higher level than and participation in the Chinese hegemonic order than any other actor. At the same time, Japan actually tended to keep its distance and assert its independence and at the level much lower than Korea. So you have a very interesting trajectories that really that makes a researcher interested in comparing why that might be the case. So that's one. And then the second reason is Vietnam is influenced by Confucian culture, the Chinese culture, but it is also an importantly part of Southeast Asian culture. So part of my research design is to see and parse out the role of culture, Chinese culture, in this case, Confucian culture. So I wanted to select the countries that were within the Confucian culture, not also in overlapped with any other.
Yeah, and that touches upon the topic of your second chapter, Chinese hegemonic authority, domestic politics explanation, right? Is there anything else you'd like there to add about how you are arguing that Chinese hegemonic authority is an outcome of not only China's material power, but also this combination of less powerful actors' domestic legitimation strategies and their resonance with this Chinese Confucian ideology?
Sure. Chapter 2 is where I discuss much of my theoretical ideas. Perhaps one can make a case that this chapter is to really speak to international relations scholars. So I was actually beginning with some of the building blocks to get to my own theoretical argument. So basically, you look at how international relations scholars try and understand this phenomena of hegemony or the hegemon, the typical understanding is that international order is creation of the power, military or economic power of the great powers only. So they tend to approach hegemony in terms of military-economic power combination. So typically, and other scholars actually have looked at the tribute system or the Chinese centered international order prior to the 19th century, only looking at China. But I do make an argument that there is the other side of hegemony in terms of agency, that is China's neighboring countries. And how about asking why the other actors actually might accept, defy, or challenge authority of hegemon? So I show in the process of researching for this book, I actually come to see how cultural and symbolic resources in addition to military and economy, are a tool for power politics. And becoming a hegemon, no matter how powerful you are, actually requires a social process of legitimating one's identity in the eyes of the other. So I try and convey this idea along with this important argument in my view, that is hegemon is not simply the international phenomena, but also we have to consider when we bring in these agency of the less powerful, the domestic calculations of these other actors. So I actually use and cite this quote from Adam Watson, who said that authority is determined not by those who yield it, but by the attitude of those who obey it. So that's where I came from in terms of investigating Japanese and Korean attitude towards the tribute system when trying to understand the Chinese-centered hegemonic order.
Then during the next three chapters, 3, 4, and 5, these are your case study chapters. And you begin with looking at the making of Ming hegemony, looking at how Korea's responses fluctuated from compliance to challenge back to compliance, and Japan from defiance to high compliance to low compliance due to domestic situations in both countries. Could you talk a little bit more about your findings from this chapter?
So because I am interested in the concept of hegemony, the scope condition temporally covers the Ming and Hai Qing. And what I actually did is to examine my argument. I look at and identify those historical moments that Japanese and Korean behavior towards China went through some drastic changes. If my argument is correct, then these drastic changes in their behavior should come from their domestic legitimations rather than changes in China's power or culture. So in chapter 3, I noted that Koreans' behavior towards China, Korea at the time was late Korea, and then we saw the establishment and the founding of a new dynasty, Joseon. I looked at how Korea's move towards military expedition actually against the Ming in 1370, and then again 1388 and 1398. And I looked and investigated why Korean behavior was fluctuating so very much. And in that same chapter, about the same time, Japanese actually behavior was somewhat, you can call it outlier behavior from other periods of Japanese diplomatic relations with China that is Japan actually decided to become a Ming tributary during the first decade of the 1400s. When I look at this case, I realized that in both cases, their responses to China was very much a function of what was going on within their own domestic situation. That is both in Joseon's case and also in Muromachi, Japan, they were actually in the process of building a new domestic political order that really needed them to assert in terms of their leaders, assert their own domestic authority in the eyes of domestic audiences, that let them behave much more assertively in terms of their relations with China. So then the question is, why when Korean king wanted to enhance their legitimacy they tend to tighten their relations with China, whereas when a Japanese shogun, Japanese leader, needed to enhance their legitimacy, they tended to distance and even criticize China. That actually comes down to the need for us to understand the social and cultural context of Japan and Korea, even when we understand the similar mechanisms of leaders seeking domestic legitimation. For Korean king, any Korean king who needed to enhance their legitimacy, you know, this goes back to the notion of the diplomatic practices. Korean king typically needed to receive investiture, the grant of the title king, in order for him to be legitimated as the king. It's a nominal process. You know, you can still be a king without that investiture, but when you do not have it, that's when you get into trouble, because that gives excuses your domestic rivals to attack you. But in the context of Japan, for any military leader, even when you're at the top of samurai hierarchy, no matter how powerful, if you want to be a leader at the national level, you needed investiture, not from the Chinese emperor, but from the Japanese emperor, because that's their social context. So they actually exhibited a different pattern. But for Japan at the time, in Chapter 3, Japan's unusual decision to receive investiture from the Ming Emperor at the time had to do with Yoshimitsu's unusual desire to actually overwhelm and assert his authority even above the emperor, because the emperor system was actually still consolidating. In Chapter 4, look at how Japan under Hideyoshi decided to challenge militarily the Ming hegemonic authority. And this is the chapter that I look at the war. You know, it's called Imjin War, or Hideyoshi's invasion of Korea between 1592 and 1598. And then in Chapter 5, I look at the other two events, comparing Korean and Japanese responses to the rise of Qing. Korean behavior was actually quite interesting, because it refused to give into a powerful rising Qing Empire's use of military power in order to support the weakening Ming Empire in the 1620s and 1630s, whereas Japan actually showed a defiance behavior and created its own miniature Japan-centered international order, especially during the earlier years of Tokugawa period in the 17th century. So, throughout these case studies, I actually show that there is a very important relationship between the domestic order formation processes and how Korea and Japan responded to the Chinese authority as the leading power. So to actually support my argument through these episodes in those time periods.
I wonder if you might speak a little bit more about the difference between the Ming dynasty and the Qing dynasty, because there really seems to be quite a strong response to the Manchus, not just as a growing power, but their ethnicity as well.
Right. So in this book, I spent quite a bit of time discussing the nature of Chinese power, basically the notion of authority, driving, resting on the symbolic power as opposed to simply military or economic. The the whole practice of receiving investiture on the part of Korea and other Asian polities had to do with this symbolic authority of the Chinese emperor as the son of heaven. But when you get to the rise of Manchus, although they actually claimed that they are the new son of heaven, they had a lot of other practices mixed up. You know, the Qing, New Qing history, you know, is famously, it has shown that the Qing rulers were not simply the son of heaven, but many other things to be able to use different identities for strategic reasons. But if you look at this question of the traditionally the Manchus who were regarded as barbarians in the eyes of Korean Confucian scholar bureaucrats, you know, the Ming and the Qing are two very different presences, regardless of their military power capabilities. So when the Qing became the new son of heaven, quote unquote, the Koreans were very resistant to send their tribute missions and receive investiture. And at the time when Qing replaced the Ming, it was during the time of the reign of King Injo, who actually became the king through coup. So he had a lot more reason to enhance his legitimacy in the eyes of his own Confucian scholar bureaucrats. But receiving the investiture from the barbarians, the Manchus, was not going to do that work. That's why you get to see how Koreans, while being fearful of watching the Manchus might be doing to their national security, could not actually sever the tributary relations with the declining Ming, still actively pursued the investiture from the Ming, even at the risk of the Qing invasion in 1627, and then again in 1636.
And you conclude your book by bringing your findings to the present day international order. So I'm wondering if you could explain to us how you see these insights applying to the contemporary East Asian world.
I would actually start by saying that I think there are important insights theoretically in terms of the importance of domestic legitimacy questions in creating and maintaining international order with a single powerful actor. But I do not necessarily project the research that's on historical era to today. Having said that, though, I think what we learned from Asian history is the importance of the decisions made by less powerful actors in Asia. When a lot of people try and understand what's going to happen to Asia, you know, we try and they tend to look at only the U.S. and Chinese positions and what they do and what kind of outcome their actions and powers are going to bring about. But I make an argument based on what we know from Asian history. The shaping, the creation and the maintenance and the shaping of a new international order is very much also a function of less powerful Asian powers. You know, what South Korea, what Japan, I mean, Japan's major power, Vietnam and other South Asian countries decide to do in terms of supporting a new kind of order, that will have an impact on the future of Asia, not simply the actions and power of China and Japan.
And do you have any other thoughts, perhaps, with recent current events what role Korea and Japan and those other countries you mentioned may have in the future workings of perhaps American or Chinese hegemony?
I think that we should look more carefully at the question of legitimacy when we think about the future of Asia. And that's where I think the transition of power, I'm not talking about the typical power transition that a lot of people are talking about, but you know, a transitioning into a new type of order requires a process, social process of legitimation. So people talk about whether, you know, it's going to be a newly China-centered order or whether U.S. is going to maintain its hegemonic status in Asia. Whatever happens in the future, it's going to entail a process of legitimation and delegitimation. So if U.S. was going to lose its influence and the current hegemonic status, I think it could be not simply about decline of American power and economic influence, but it's also going to be about the kind of appeal that the U.S. had, the symbolic power aspect. And for China as well, when China wants to become a new leading power in Asia, especially in view of American hegemony, I think it will have to consider how other actors are actually look at China in terms of the symbolic power of China. And I think in that regard, we don't really get a very clear picture right now because we're kind of Asia is presenting a lot of challenges in terms of the bifurcation of military and economic power, but also in terms of sovereignty claims and historical claims. So a lot of things actually will be there are a lot of moving parts here.
Well, Jiyeon, I think we've taken up enough of your time. So I'd like to ask you a final question. Could you tell us what you're working on right now?
I'm actually working on something that is more contemporary. So I have a project that is looking at how foreign policy signaling works at times of a lot of uncertainties, especially in the context of Asia. So it is about foreign policy signaling and reassurance. And I'm curious to find out how countries, actors, they try to reassure others about their good intentions, benign intentions, even when they pursue strategic hedging against uncertainties over others' potentially malign intentions. Empirically, I look at this question in terms of the contemporary security dynamic in East Asia, particularly with the rise of China and the future of U.S. alliance system in East Asia. So that's what I'm currently working on.
Jiyeon, that sounds like a great project. I want to thank you for being on the show again today. I really enjoyed it, and take care.
Thank you so much.
You've been listening to New Books in East Asian Studies, part of the New Books Network. Thank you so much, and we'll see you next time.